Mother's to film reviews to start tonight. Mother's Instinct tells the story of two best friends and neighbours whose idyllic lives in 60 suburbia are shattered by a tragic accident involving one of their children. Jessica Chastain plays Alice, Anne Hathaway plays Celine, and the film follows the unravelling of their sisterly bond, replaced by guilt, paranoia and a battle of wills. The Origin of Evil is our second film. It follows Laura Calame as she's playing this scheming woman, Stéphane. She's on the verge of financial collapse as she emerges from obscurity to try and infiltrate her estranged and extravagantly wealthy father's family. There's bits and knives out in here. There's certainly shades of Succession, film filled with suspicion, backstabbing and betrayal. The audience kept guessing on the characters' motivations throughout. And finally, The Beautiful Game stars Bill Nighy as Mal, the manager of England's homeless football team, tasked with taking his players to Rome with the hope of being crowned champions of the Homeless World Cup. Striker Vinny, played by Michael Ward, is a last-minute addition to the squad who may offer the team a real chance of winning, but only if he can beat his own demons and let go of the past. Gemma Cray, Donald Clark have been to the movies for us. They're with me in studio this evening. And let's start with Mother's Instinct, which tells the story of these two women, Alice and Celine, played by Jessica Chastain and Anne Hathaway, respectively, if I haven't mixed up the two characters. So maybe tell me who each of the two women are and the kind of background, the kind of milieu that we're moving in here, Gemma.
Yeah, well, it's 1960s suburbia. These are two housewives in a very wealthy neighbourhood. It's a very picturesque space with a nod to Americana. Everyone looks pristine. There's a lot of money around, but there's a lot of old school ideas as well. These are two very much so like stay-at-home mothers. That is very much so their only role. Alice, played by Jessica Chastain, longs to go back and admits to Celine, played by Anne Hathaway, how much she really longs to go back to her career as a journalist. But the guilt is there because they both have kids the same age. They both see themselves as mothers first and foremost. And that's where we begin the friendship. They're very close. They're confidants. Yeah. They're two couples that live next door to each other and share everything.
And essentially, even though we're talking about two couples here and two young boys, for part of the movie at any rate, because there is a tragedy in the midst of all of this, it is the dynamic between the two women that this film is really exploring.
Yeah.
Donald.
Yeah, and I mean, Chastain and Hathaway deserve to have statues erected to them for the work that they do here. It's completely and utterly fabulous in a film that may not be fabulous. I mean, it's such a peculiar piece of work emerging here before its US release. I mean, I get a US release, I don't know. It's kind of sneaking out at a peculiar point in the year. I mean, I felt sitting watching these gorgeous costumes and the beautiful cinematography and this very, to my mind, arch depiction of a point in American history that became sort of obsessed with in popular culture about 10 or 12 years ago, around the era of Mad Men.
Yeah.
That kind of pre-lapsarian America, the 60s before it became the 1960s, before everything fell apart, that world became obsessed with. That's all created so lavishly that I was sucked into it. But I couldn't know while I was watching it, I was making ugh and ugh noises and going, oh, no, really? And those is so preposterous all the way through. And it's so mannered in terms of how it's produced. Yeah. It's very hard to take seriously, to the extent that I found produced my notes afterwards, scrawled in the dark, barely legible, but at some point I'd written, is this bad? Maybe this is actually good.
Well, okay.
And I'm still not
you're
quite
still not sure.
Okay,
so your critic's instinct has kind of been
about. I would not have missed it for the world, but I'm still not entirely convinced if it's good or bad, okay, for want of a better
fair
word.
Enough. Well, let's listen to a bit of Mother's Instinct and see if we can sense if the instincts of both Jessica Chastain as Alice and Anne Hathaway as Celine are in tune here. There has been a tragedy. It has involved a balcony, and there will be, or that is going to happen at some point. And this is a conversation between the two women where one of the sons has veered perilously close to the balcony, and there's a real tension between the two of them.
Did you put Theo on that balcony? To test me? Do you think I'm capable of something like that? Celine. It helps me to spend time with Theo, and it helps him too. He's lonely, Alice. He's like a ghost without Max. Can't you see that? And did he use him to test you?
Sorry, I'm sorry. I feel terrible for getting there for Theo and not for Max. I'm very sorry. Please forgive me. Please.
There you go. That's Jessica Chastain as Alice, Anne Hathaway as Celine, in what is clearly quite an emotionally wrought scene. And it seems to veer from this perfectly coiffed, high-heeled, perfectly made-up two women to these two women who find themselves in this absolute emotional abyss.
And what's very interesting is I think their world very much so becomes a prison. The two husbands act as very different forms of antagonists to their wives as the tension rises and as the drama unfolds. And you really feel the sense of like these two women are almost trapped in a cage with one another. And in her performance there, Anne Hathaway delivers that line so earnestly and vulnerable. And, you know, Jessica is questioning herself. Jessica's character, Alice, is questioning herself. She's like, am I mad? She's someone with a history of mental illness. She's seen great tragedy in her life. And she wants to really believe her friends. But Celine's other actions are incongruent, and a lot of strange things has been happening. And again, she's like a trained journalist that knows her stuff. So there's this back and forth that we, the audience, do question ourselves because Hathaway's performance there is so earnest.
Right, okay. So there you go. You're having a few questions about the, I don't know if it's quite as firm as Donald's questions about the bad, good, whether it's bad or good.
Donald's deranged sense of uncertainty about this.
Is that sense of uncertainty, I won't use the adjective, down to the directorial debut here of Benoît Delhomme, who a celebrated cinematographer for, what, three decades at least, at the very least. Is that where the problem lies?
Well, I think, I mean, certainly it's a very elegantly carried off production. So I think
so it looks great.
It looks, well, I think what I'm trying to get at here is it looks too great.
Right.
I mean, it is framed so beautifully and so archly that it is quite hard to take seriously. I think the problems are all over the place. I mean, there are problems in almost every area. The plotting is certainly a difficulty. I don't want to give anything away, but Gemma was talking there a great deal about we're questioning the Chastain's character, questioning her sanity. In the middle of the film appears to be veering off towards one of the more familiar plots from suspense cinema. Well, it's been in the film.
We're in the world of
twice.
Hitchcock in many ways here.
Well, there's a particular film I'm thinking of, but I'm not going to say it. I'm going to give it away. But in the middle, we're going in one direction. And then at the end, it swivels back and to somewhere really what we thought it was always going all along, more specific than that, in a quite conventional, quite dull and unimaginative fashion. But I felt that if this film was being, if Todd Haynes had directed this film with the same actresses and the same screenplay and the same camera setups, it probably would have been a masterpiece. It could have got there. As it is so uncertain as to what its relationship is with the time and with the drama and with the structure that I couldn't decide
one way or the other.
One way or the other, once again.
Are we 2.5 out of 5 then? Are we stuck in the middle?
Out of 5 or 1 or 2 or 3? Let's give it 3 and be cowardly about it.
So worth going to see and make up your own mind.
I wouldn't have missed it for the world, but I couldn't again tell you for certain if it's a good film.
All right, Gemma.
I actually have a thesis on this. Benoît came in, stepped in when the original director stepped off. And all the, like, he's a DOP. This is a behemoth of a film. These are two very, very established actresses. This is a big world that he has to build. And a lot of plot twists. And it's very, very well-worn territory. I just maybe think he's a great director, but this was probably a bad first choice.
Okay.
The issue with it is that maybe it doesn't gel quite so well. The pacing isn't quite there. There's so much of this does work. I would give it 3.5 for that reason, because it's a spectacle. It's a cinematic spectacle.
Okay, well, I think I need to go to see it just to make up my own mind now. But and it sounds as if it's worth the effort to make up one's mind on that regard. Right, let's move on to another French thriller. Well, no, a French thriller. I'm going to have another one in a minute. The Origin of Evil, which follows Stefan, who works as an anchovy packer in a local fish plant. But she has aims to infiltrate her estranged and wealthy father's business empire. And you both laugh, as I say, and well, Jovi Packer.
I'm sorry, but it does sound like a euphemism. I mean, there's no way around it.
Well, that's what she's doing, and making fish soup as well. Is that, I don't know whether that's
no problem with
that's
that.
That's a very clear, yeah. Okay. So, tell us a little bit more about her anchovy packing, which is putting little small fish into a box.
Are we going to discuss her job in the fish plant for the rest of the review? She does indeed work in a fish plant. Yeah. Yes, literally so.
Yeah, she works there, but that's the only bit of truth we get about her.
Pretty much.
Because that's where the lies start immediately.
I like this, I must say. I mean, it's interesting that there are a lot of comparisons in plot terms with Mother's Instinct, another film from a French source that deals with a potentially murderous rivalry between two women. There was a lot more to it in this case. That's not necessarily at the centre of the piece. Laura Calamy, who you've seen in Call My Agent, plays this person who works in a fish packing factory, who early on turns up and announces herself to be the missing daughter of a multimillionaire who lives on an island with his ghastly family. And it probably is giving nothing away to say that doubts begin to emerge if she is who she says she is. But I think it's very skillfully sows those doubts throughout the 2 hours, and you get solutions to some of the questions that you ask early on at just the right point to keep you interested.
Or you don't get solutions, but another kind of complication or twist is thrown in that asks a whole other set of questions that you're quite happy to wait on the answers for. If we were in the world of Mad Men to a certain extent in Mother's Instinct, we're definitely in the world of Succession here.
Yeah, Succession and Saltburn. Yeah, but it's very French. Like there's kind of like a freeness to the to the world as well. Like there's a very strange Serge and who he's
the dad.
Yeah, he's that kind of patriarchal tycoon style. And the character of Nathalie, who's pretending to be his daughter, their relationship becomes quite physical and like almost sensual. Like you feel like the way that they physically interact from a very early stage is like old lovers. It's strange, and I think this film tonally is strange. Like I just started, I clicked play and I didn't quite know what to expect, and then I was like, is this a horror? Is this, do you know, like, is this a comedy? Because
I thought it started like a piece. I thought it was going to be in some kind of documentary situation because the shower room of the fish factory. Did we really need that?
Like how many topless, like who goes into a factory and just takes off their top as a woman and hangs out
odd, because for most of the film it struck me as being quite a tasteful kind of Claude Chabrol kind of operation, the sort of post-Hitchcock Chabrolian mystery that plays out quite subtly for a large part. And then there are all these weird bits of kind of like nude wrestling in prisons and things and the shower scene that we've discussed, which seem to come from an entirely different, more exploitative film.
Yeah, and Laura Calamy's character her lover is in prison for the most of the film.
I felt like there are scenes, and if they're intimate scenes, maybe they should be justified.
Yeah.
I feel like, and in the past couple of years, like if you do watch something, there's a purpose to that interaction. We're learning something about the characters. But there's so many beats in this that show people in very sort of compromised positions, very open, and I feel the camera just lingers too long, like a bit of a creep.
However, this is 2 hours long, and I must say I didn't feel a single minute of it. It kind of flew along, so it's 2 hours. I'm usually giving out about that type of thing. Did it work overall for you, Donald?
It did, yeah. I mean, it's one of those films, and I like this. This is not a criticism. Almost everyone is awful. I mean, in fact, thinking about it, probably the character who is the most, not likeable is the word, but the character who is least reprehensible is actually the person who's in prison for murder. and I think that's obviously a deliberate decision on their part. But I like that. I like films that don't feel that they have to give you someone you can identify
with. Yeah.
And I thought, I do think that actually the questions are posed very delicately and they are answered quite subtly at just the right point in the film you want them to be answered. So yeah, I thought it worked very well for me.
Stars?
Four.
Four, good solid four. And what are you saying, Gemma?
I said 4.5. I felt tonally this just did something so offbeat that the way the performances were enacted, like, I mean, I've never seen an awkward people-pleasing sociopath con woman before, played so uncomfortably and squirmishly.
Yeah, she's not kind of like a glamorous Hitchcockian character, is she?
And I must say, the best ending, twist of an ending that I've seen in a long time, and that as much as I'm going to say. I thought it was a wonderful ending. So 4 and 4.5. Move on briefly to The Beautiful Game. This is Bill Nye is the manager of the English homeless football team, who champions the troubled star Vinny, played by Michael Ward, while chasing the crown for the Homeless World Cup. I feel good movie has written all over it.
It absolutely is. I mean, the thing we should say quickly, given that this is about homeless people playing football in the Homeless World Cup, a very commendable organisation, is that there are really no attempt whatsoever to engage with the really desperate challenges that homeless, desperate reality is a better word, yes, that homeless people face when they're not participating in international football competitions. But okay, you don't have to do that. It's perfectly acceptable to make a sunny, optimistic film about that subject and to approach it from that angle. And it's really pleasant. I mean, at the end of a rather bitter March, I was perfectly happy to sink into this film, which is set in a sunny, attractive version of Rome. And good to see Tom Von Lauder gets with the Irish goalkeeper.
He's the goalkeeper, yeah. Let's have a listen to a clip featuring Bill Nye as Mal telling Vinny, who's the man he really wants to be on the team, what the Homeless World Cup is. And I think this kind of tells us what the film is.
So, the football competition, street soccer, four aside, really fast, some excellent players, all homeless.
Homeless?
Yeah, all homeless. It's called the Homeless World Cup. There'll be players coming to Rome from all over the world. From Cape Town to Copenhagen. Some great athletes, some who can barely kick a ball. Makes no difference. When that ball goes in, everyone goes crazy.
Samson, you're coming with us to Rome. You're going to represent South Africa. You're going to win this thing.
And every player has a story to tell. Heartbreaking, unexpected, thrilling stories.
I got picked!
And they tell those stories in one great universal language. And that's football.
There you go, 1 minute and 5 seconds of a clip, which makes me feel good even just playing that. So I guess the film just picks up on all of that positivity, given the little caveat that Donald has about that, you know, the realities of the homeless situation are not explored.
You could say, oh, this is very lighthearted for a film about homelessness. Or you could say this is like an upbeat, feel-good football feel that has a darker side to it. Mm. Like, it does touch on the tragedies. It's probably the darkest one of those feel-good football type films. I mean, like Ted Lasso, it does deal with mental health and that kind of
So there was a bit of substance there as well as the feel-goodness.
Yeah, like, I mean, I really felt the pain of basically the main character, Vinny. He's played by Michael Ward. He is a powerful athlete who is really struggling now. He had such promise as a child. He was, you know, going to play for West Ham. He was picked. He was seen as something special. And all that was pulled away from him. And now he's struggling to come to terms with how to eke out a life past this. And that's sort of his arc that he's working through over the course of this story. And he's a brilliant performer, and you feel that pain with him, and everyone has their little arc.
Is it wrong of us to want more from Tom Von Lauder, which I think you did?
No, it's not wrong of us, I think. He's been underused, because he's a great actor, and the character, from what we see of him, is very charming. So yes, I wanted more Von Lauder action.
Right.
That's what I was
and
saying.
And the sport itself, the little four-a-side kick-arounds, do they work as...
I think it probably works very well, actually, on cinema, because it is easier to give a representation of the entire action.
Four aside, that 11 aside.
Yeah.
Okay. Stars from you in this one, Donald.
You could not get a more three-starsy film. Three stars.
Three stars.
In the context of sports films, I'll give it 4 stars. I thought it was one of the better ones that I had seen.
All right. That's Gemma Cray and Donald Clark talking to us about Mother's Instinct, which is on general release. The Origin of Evil is at selected cinemas. And The Beautiful Game is available on Netflix from tomorrow. For the author of The Cow Book, activist and farmer John Connell, the dream of turning Granard in County Longford into a book town came to pass last year with the first ever Granard Book Town Festival. I'm glad to tell you Granard Book Town is back for its second year. It will run from April the 19th through to the 21st. An impressive programme of events, including one of the guests who is with us this evening, American-born singer-songwriter John Murray, who, among other talents, has a great knack for a title. His last album was called Stars Are God's Bullet Holes. There's also an award-winning documentary, The Graceless Age, The Ballad of John Murray, telling the story of his neglected childhood, eventful and often traumatic life. It premiered at the Galway Film Fly last year, and delighted that John Murray joins us from our Galway studios this evening. Good to have you with us, John. You're a Mississippi man, originally.
I am.
Related to both literary greats and to the Comanche tribe. That's quite,
that's quite
a lineage.
Yeah, that's what happens when you're adopted and you're American, isn't it? I mean, you know, it's kind of strange, huh? Yeah.
Well, give us the literary lineage first of all.
So I'm related to William Faulkner through adoption on my father's side. And I spent every weekend in the first couple of years of my life in Oxford, Mississippi, about a block from where he's buried. And my grandfather's buried there as well. So I'm named after Faulkner's grandfather, and then I don't know, his father's first name was Murray, so you know.
And even though that's an adopted lineage, if you like.
Well, if you grow up around him, it's far more affecting, isn't it?
Yeah. I was going to ask you that. You know, how affecting was it? I believe books were a big thing in your house, which was unhappy in many ways, but not in that respect.
No, not in that respect. My dad, he kept a bookcase outside of my room, and he would just kind of put things out there. I've tried to talk to him about this, you know, the books that he put out there, because it's confusing to try to figure out what he actually believed. He put things like the autobiography of Malcolm X and the Communist Manifesto, and then, you know, other things that kind of, things that just don't, people's history of the United States, things that I wonder, like, how, to what degree does he agree with things like this, you know, or whatever, but it's things that formed, you know, the way that I think about the world, and then a whole lot of literature, and I don't know, it kind of got me going. There wasn't a whole lot to do in Tupelo, Mississippi. There's still not. So, you know, I read a lot.
So reading was a big part of that.
Yeah, and I think that I think William Faulkner to me was he was a character who, you know, the family started the name Count No Count and things like that. So he would walk around Oxford, Mississippi with a beret on, and I think maybe I felt that way a bit, you know? Like a bit of an outsider, and so I kind of gravitated towards his writing.
Well, did you read Tolstoy at home?
I did read Tolstoy. Good call there. Yeah,
yeah. I wonder how I knew that.
I wonder. Yeah, so, there was
one of the songs that you're going to perform. Well, go ahead and tell us about the reading of Tolstoy when you were at home. Anyway.
Well, I mean, this is actually a Yiddish translation of the same title of a Beethoven sonata. So. A Ukrainian Jewish man. The first stage adaptation was done by him, and so it's the Yiddish.
And that's why we have Die Kreutz, the Kreutzer Sonata.
Yeah, and so they were then. So this is kind of, it was kind of a desperate time, right? And neither one of them were Bolsheviks, and it was kind of. I mean, I'm not. This has nothing to do with politics, but both he and Tolstoy were kind of. Desperate, you know, and I think, I don't know, maybe something in the song is that way as well. I don't know.
So do you think of this as what is the relationship for you between the reading of that Tolstoy book and what it said to you? Maybe you tell me a little bit about that, and how that makes its way into this song, if that isn't asking you to open up a Pandora's box that you might want to open.
It might take you a year or two to get about, I mean, for me to figure it out. I think it has something to do with, you know, this is one of those things I can't quite figure out myself, but like, I don't even know what my attraction to that novella was. I mean, it's about like the idea that, you know, if we cease to procreate, we bring about the end of the world because that would be best for all of us. And, you know, I don't actually agree with that. And then this is not long before Tolstoy, you know, froze to death, walk into the train. So, and this is a story that a man tells on a train to a passenger across from him. So I think it has more to do with a sense of time and place, and time and place changing, you know, dramatically and quickly. And I think that's why I went with, you know, a Ukrainian Jewish man stage adaptations, translation as a title. And it's also, you know, a Beethoven sonata, and the Ode to Joy came out 200 years before the record. So I thought it was kind of funny. It's not funny, though, is it? You know what I mean? I mean, these jokes are not, jokes.
Yeah, as you say, the idea that, you know, the best way to save the world is to stop procreating is kind of...
That doesn't sound fun, does it?
A little bit drastic.
You know, that's what I'm saying. I mean, you know, Tolstoy's wife must not have been a fan. You know,
I would think not. I would think not. Let's have a listen to the song, if we could, John.
Dig up the old man's wishing well. Ought to get started. Done this all before. Better get started. I know I'm not what you bargained for. The word bargain implied a little more. That's for sure, it's all right. It's not like I'm every other guy that you know. Be gone in the morning. Better get started before I fade away. Raid your mom's liquor cabinet. Better get started while they're out dragging the lake. They've done that before, yeah. I know I'm not what you bargained for, but the word bargain implied a little more. That's what I told you for. It's alright, it's not like I'm every other guy that you've known. A one night stand, you'll throw me out in the mornings. I'm not gonna make it. 'Cause I'm stuck somewhere between memory and a dream. Con and a scheme. It doesn't mean a thing. Make it up as I go. Family tree, 'cause there's nothing left but greed, blood, money, and property. Love doesn't mean a thing. Your last name is Murray, and could have been Swindle.
John Murray performing his song there, Die Kreutzer Sonata. John is live in our Galway studio this evening. Even as you sang that last little section of the song, the version of the song that you gave us there, John, when you refer directly to yourself, your love doesn't mean a thing. Your last name is Murray. Could have been Swindle. I would guess it takes a lot of bravery to write and sing about yourself like that.
Yeah, I don't even know if I like that line, and you know, like it's one of those kind of things. It's I remember doing that, and that second half of the song, was working on the record with John Parrish, and I intentionally didn't finish it. You know, kind of wanted to see if I could just come up with something and make myself a bit uncomfortable, put some pressure on myself in the studio, and just see what came out, and that's kind of what happened. And I remember thinking, like, this is not. Do I even feel that way? You know, do I even think that? But
to say what was in there.
Yeah, well, you had to kind of come out with it. Yeah.
It struck me, to what extent was that the same? Was that a similar process for you in the film The Graceless Age, which is the ballad of John Murray? The ballad of John Murray clearly is, you know, the story of you. It was directed by Sarah Scher, and you went back to Mississippi. I mentioned the difficult family life. While the books were great, there was a very difficult part to your early family life, and you retrace that the ballad of The Graceless Age, the ballad of John Murray. How difficult was that?
Well, initially, I mean, it was really, really difficult. It was an 8-year process that we spent a long time making the film, and a lot of that had to do with my own, I think, hesitancy and fear of doing it, and also just, I mean, things changed over time. My own relationship to the idea of what the things that were traumatizing to me when I was younger and what I wanted them to be, what I going forward, you know, as an adult, like what I wanted those things to mean in relation to like what power they had over me or what power I had over them. Those things changed, and so it was a hell of a process. I mean, it was something that I've got to say, the crew, the team of people that worked on that with me, I love them. They went through we got into knockdown, drag out fights, you know, and I'm just shocked and surprised that the whole thing got done at all. Yeah. You know, I mean, when we were done with it, we were all kind of hugging, and I was thinking, I hated all you guys like a month ago, and then I loved you a month before that. But my relationship with my own adoption, I think I've kind of come to terms with, there's things that I'll never know, you know, in terms of like legally how things were done, or my relationship with my adopted parents, the things that I went through as a kid with them. A lot of that stuff, it became easier for me to bury a hatchet, I suppose, because I wanted to have a relationship with my family, which is not what I thought. I thought I was kind of going to war with them almost at the beginning of making the thing, and then
something, you know, different. I'm wondering about, I mean, what happened essentially, if and correct me if I'm giving a very blunt version of this. You were adopted by your childhood, fostered then your grandparents to your grandparents, and that was where there were real difficult problems, wasn't it?
Well, I was adopted by See, my birth certificate says that my parents are my legal parents, and my adopted father is a lawyer, so it doesn't really make sense, right? But I pushed to find out who my biological parents were. I was my adoptive grandparents sort of raised me, but no, I'm biologically related to a couple other folks, you know. My mother and father I mean, even the process of making the film, my biological father, his name was James Swindle. So that's actually...
That's where that line
comes
from.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's funny as hell. you know, because the people are like, ha, what does that mean? Well, it literally means, you know. He died not long after I found him, you know, and my biological mother decided that she would disown me. I mean, I was kind of like, well, look, lady, I'm, you know... You don't own me anyway, so that's kind of strange. The whole thing is—it's been like this unexpected, you know, trip of an experience, you know.
And
so,
and from that move to your grandparents and your parents, then you were sent off to an institution where things were.
I was sent to a fundamentalist Christian drug rehabilitation center. There's a program called The Program on Netflix right now that's about a place that's quite similar to the one I was in. It was called Second Chance, and in fact it comes from the same kind of parent organization. I was sexually assaulted there by three teenagers. Well, two of them were young adults and one was a teenager, and for about 2.5 weeks, and yeah, it was a brutal place. It was a horrible place.
And at what point along the way did you mentioned then about discovering your birth family and getting the details on that, and this lineage, I talked about the lineage back to, am I right in saying it's your great great grandfather who was the last Comanche chief of the Comanche tribe? If people know,
well, great great grandmother, so like Cynthia Ann Parker was his mother, and then great grandfather was Quanah Parker. Yeah.
Yeah, so if people might remember that name, Cynthia, because that leads us into John Ford and the Searchers, doesn't it?
Yeah, I didn't know that. My friend Paul Dwan, he made a film recently, and he told me, you know, that's what that's about. And then I realized, oh yeah, I've seen that film. That is what that's about. And you know, because they kind of leave out the Quanah Parker grows up and then becomes the last chief of the Comanche and the last Indian to fight whites, and then he becomes the first Indian that's elected sheriff or elected anything of Lawton, Oklahoma, and then he went on to he and his daughters starred in the first Western as the Indians, and so yeah.
So the character played by Natalie Wood is in fact a relative of yours in that yeah. John Ford film.
Yeah.
So it strikes me that maybe Southern Sky to a certain extent kind of gathers a lot of that material in some ways, certainly just in its title. Now the song takes on a whole other set of meanings as we'll hear. Can you lead me into it? I know you had to retune the guitar as you managed to tell me those stories and retune it at the same time.
We got it done.
Good. Well, lead me into Southern Sky and maybe give us a little bit of detail before you perform it for us.
Sure, John. We'll do. Yeah, this is off of The Graceless Age. So this is what the documentary was named after. It's the first record that I made, say, 11 years ago. And I remember naming this that because I wanted to kind of, you know, I'm from the South, and we like to think that we're better than other people because we are better than other people. That's what Croconians say, isn't it? And so, you know, and they're wrong. But, I mean, you know, they're not. I mean, well, they're kind of wrong. They are wrong. We can't tell them that, can we?
No.
It's okay. I just said that I could get shot.
Well, you're going to Granard in Longford, so you're safe enough. Giving out about the Cork audience.
That's it. I'm safe in Longford. I know where I am. that's it. I think Mark Eitzel wrote a song called Western Sky, and I thought I'm just gonna do this to kind of make fun of him, you know. But he never he didn't think it was either. He wasn't entertained, so. You know, I mean, it was kind of a failure of a title, but
not a failure of a song. Let's hear it.
It's a good song. Here we go. I was asleep, woke up to the sound of it, sashaying down the hall, remnants of secrets, our precious lies. Terrified of it all. Got no past. There is no future. Sickness follows me around. Got no time. The hour's nearing. Gonna burn this old house down. She knows my face. My broken body, still see it in her eyes. The crucifix that bound our bodies beneath the southern sky. We were trapped in the crowd, cheated by misfortune. Used to pray it's like be your God in my arms, these crooked arms beneath the southern sky. The devil's paintbrush holds just one color. Pushes out her form. She laughs and tells me, playing with matches, that'll only keep you warm. Stars are falling all around us, in this filthy little town. While I slept there, you screamed into your pillow. I'm so sorry, I never heard a sound. She knows my face, my broken body, still see it in her eyes. That crucifix that bound our body. We were underneath the southern sky, trapped in the crowd, cheated by misfortune. Pray as I be your God into my arms, these crooked arms beneath the southern sky. She knows my face, my broken body. Still see it in her eyes. A crucifix bound our bodies underneath the southern sky. We're trapped in the crowd, cheated by misfortune. I used to pray his life be your guide. Into my arms, into these broken, twisted arms, underneath the southern sky.
There we go, Southern Sky from John Murray. John performing in our Galway studio this evening. He's on a little sojourn in Galway, but living in Longford for the last 8 years. And that is where he will be in conversation with Aidan Gillen in Fez Bar, in fact, at 7:15 on Friday, April the 19th in Granard, County Longford, as part of the Granard Booktown Festival. Full information on granardbooktownfestival.ie. After a lifetime of playing memorable characters like Bobby Grant in Channel 4's Brookside, Jim Royle in The Royal Family, Ricky Tomlinson is coming to Ireland next week in Irish Annies, a musical comedy where he gets to play himself, or a version of himself at the very least. The show tours to two venues in Dublin, then Drogheda, Galway and Cork in one very busy week. Don't know where he gets the energy, but I'm delighted that he's found the energy to join me down the line this evening. Ricky Tomlinson, you're very welcome to Arena. Scouse Pete is the character name here. Is that a big fat lie? Is Ricky Tomlinson actually the character that you're playing, Ricky?
I'm playing myself. I'm just playing myself. Every pub has a busybody, and that's me. Every pub. So it's just a typical Irish parlour in a pub. Lovely, lovely lady runs the pub, and I'm sort of the local fella who pops in, tells a few stories to the people in the pub, and then joins in all the music. The music, it's absolutely great. We have a live four-piece band on stage. And the lad who wrote the play and stars in the play is a lad called Asa Murphy, who's from a Liverpool Irish family. Mm. He's got a load of brothers, and you've only got to look at them. You don't need to say to them, where are you from? You know where they're from as soon as you come in the room. But we've been having a ball. We've been up and down the country. People, it's like Glastonbury for pensioners there. It's wonderful. They're all right. They come towards the end of the stage and they're waving their scarves and their handbags and their pension books, and they're all singing along, and it's wonderful. Honestly, I'm probably older than them, but I'm loving every minute of it.
Enjoying it for sure. And
I am.
I don't know if did Jim Royle ever give us a song, or did Bobby Grant ever give us a song? Does Ricky Tomlinson give us a song in Irish Annies?
Well, Annie's? I used to. I join in all the songs because Ace is the lad, and as I say, but the thing is, the only disappointments I've got arthritis in my finger. I can't play my banjo. But I mean, it's not missed because, as I say, we've got a wonderful band on stage, and everywhere we've been, it's been amazing. And for me, the beauty of the show is, after the show, I spend as much time in the foyer with people getting selfies, and I take photographs and caricatures and give them all out and have the crack with people, you know. But I'm really looking forward to coming over to Ireland because I've worked with some lovely, lovely Irish actors, you know, like Liam Cunningham and Lorcan Cranitch, and in the old days, you'll probably remember old Jimmy Ellis.
Not even I can remember quite that far, I'm afraid, Ricky.
Can't you?
No.
I'm going on 85, so I'm probably a bit older than you.
Yeah, I'm a little bit behind you.
but Jimmy Ellis was a wonderful actor. He was wonderful and a wonderful person. We had a great laugh. He was in Boys from the Black Stuff, which was a great big hit, you know.
Yeah.
But as I say, Asa Murphy, his parents are actually from Ireland, and they're Liverpool Irish. I guess the music's infectious.
Yeah, and I guess that, I mean, you would know that world. You'd know, there may not be a Liverpool Irish pub called Irish Annie's, but there's one just like Irish Annie's for sure. And you would have known that community growing up in the North of England. And of course, from your life as the start out before you ever turned near acting at all in the building industry.
That's right. But my wife, it was her birthday not long ago. And there's a lad we met in Spain. He's an Irish lad, a wonderful musician. I only know him as Mick. And he came over to Ireland, and we met in one of the well-known pubs in Liverpool. And he performed all afternoon. It was wonderful. But we've kept in touch with this lad for years and years and years. Mm. And he's a fabulous musician. And he plays the flute and the guitar and the saxophone. So we've got strong connections, really, with Ireland. And as I say, Liverpool was the capital of Ireland for a while, wasn't it? But I love it. I love the songs. I love the little storyline. There's a little bit of romance in it. Unfortunately, it's not me doing the romantic part. So I'd forgotten what to do. So they had to get someone else in to play that.
Well, the other thing that struck me about this was, you know, Irish Annie set in a pub and all the rest of it. I don't know if you saw Ken Loach's recent film, The Old Oak, which was set in an old English pub in many ways. But it has the feel. I know this is very much a feel-good night out, but it's you telling old anecdotes and probably, I would guess, improvising quite a lot as you go along.
I improvise quite a lot, absolutely, depending on what part of the country you're in or what town we're in. Yeah, we make a few little stories up and we do all that. But you know, you mentioned Ken Loach there. I've done two wonderful movies with him. He's an incredible character.
Yeah, Riff Raff and Raining Stones.
That's right. But he's wonderful. And, you know, I still keep in touch with Loachy. I still keep in touch, and we exchange a little letter every now and again. But, this Irish Annie, it's been... See, this is really my first part on the stage, because I bluffed my way into the... When I come out of prison, I bluffed my way into the television industry, got lucky, worked with Roland Joffe, met De Niro, met Samuel Jackson... And then it ended up now, you know, it's at nearly 85. I'm treading the boards and I'm loving it.
How different is that feeling, you know, being on the stage in front of a live audience? Very different from being in front of a camera.
Well, it is, you see, because, you know, if you're in front of the camera and you fluff a line, you just redo it. Not on the stage, you can't. You've got to remember your lines, get round it. But I like putting ad-libs in, and sometimes it throws me and throws the other people.
I guess, you know, in some ways you ad-libbed your way, even though you may not have known you were doing it. When Roland Joffe, as you talk about that moment when he auditioned you in London Weekend Television, I think it was, and he was sitting there with his feet up on a table.
Oh,
you lost the rag.
On a polished table.
You lost the rag with him.
I did. Well, you know, I was with Red and a little two up, two down council house with just a cold water tap, and you dare not put your feet on a polished chair or a polished table. You'd have got a clip around the ear. And when I seen him do it, and you know what, you know, I put a false name obviously on the interview papers when I wrote away for an interview, but he knew who it was. I don't know how he found out, but we became real good friends, and I went to stay with him in London for a few days. And he's abroad now. He works abroad where he's got a film academy, and he training kids, working class kids like myself, to get into the film game. And that he's a wonderful person.
And I guess what he did there was he got you to be yourself and to, you know, to really let rip at him. And he thought,
absolutely. Yeah. And but you see, it was luck as well, because when it was actually shown, the movie was called United Kingdom, and it's never been shown again. They've never shown it again because it was so controversial. But while it was being shown on a Saturday night, Brookside was coming into being. And they had half a dozen writers, and Andy Lynch and Jimmy McGovern and Alan Swift. They were all writing storylines. And Andy Lynch was watching the programme on the telly, spotted me doing a scene where I'm screaming, you know, being the old like shop steward. And he just phoned Phil Redmond and said, "We found Bobby Grant." There you go.
And, you know, and you mentioned being in prison, and many people will know that that came from a strike, and you're put in there. But you actually, even though you were pardoned, whatever number of years later, I think it was a couple of years back, you were given a pardon, that there was no need for you to be sent to prison at all at that time.
It was the authorities put us in jail, didn't it? Our telephones were tapped and our mail was intercepted and all that sort of stuff.
All part of the builder's strike at the time.
And the one and only ever, by the way, the only one and only ever building strike. That's all it was. The first one. And, you know, recently there was an MP, and God bless him, he was murdered. He was doing a surgery and he got murdered. And there was an outcry, and they all stood up in Parliament and said, no one should die going just because they've gone to work. Well, what they forgot is every day in the building industry, someone dies. Someone dies every single day. The death toll in the building industry when we went on strike was in the hundreds. And the real bad injuries were in the tens of thousands. And that was part of the thing
that's what the strike was all about. So there was a very serious side. And I'm sure there will be serious stories as well as fun stories told as part of Irish Annie as well. But thanks so much for being with us this evening, Ricky. Wish we had a bit more time. But
if you can make it to the show, pop along, but bring your dancing shoes. You need your dancing. But listen, the last time I was in Ireland, I went to see that Michael Flatley, you know, the river dance.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, he didn't like me joining then. He didn't like it.
Well, I expect to see your river dance then when we get to see you. Thanks for being with us this evening, Ricky. That's Ricky Tomlinson. Irish Annie's is at the Civic Theatre in Tallaght, 2nd and 3rd of April, Liberty Hall, Dublin, 4th and 5th of April, Crescent Concert Hall in Drogheda, 6th of April, Town Hall Theatre in Galway, 7th of April, Everyman in Cork on the 8th and 9th. Bring your dancing shoes and you'll get lots of selfies, it would seem, as well. IrishAnnies.com for full details there. And that is our lot for this Thursday evening, isn't it? Niall Fitzmaurice was the researcher. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Sound supervision this evening, Tommy O'Sullivan and John Doyle in Galway. Tonight's programme produced by Reggie Libby. Apologies to John Creedon. I'm a little bit over time. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. And John will be with you after the news.